This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I'm actually a little bit new to this field. This is a little outside of what I've done for most of my research career. So I think I can be a little unbiased when I say that what we know about nutrition and human evolution is a huge scientific success story written largely by the people you're going to hear from here today. We'd like to suggest that there is a missing piece that could be really important. And we think that that missing piece has to do with microbial contributions to host health, nutrition, and evolution. What we're mainly interested in are bacteria, including archaea, viruses, and tiny eukaryotes that are organized into microbiomes, or communities of microorganisms living in close association with hosts. And when I talk about hosts, I'm going to be referring really just to primates in this particular talk. Now, what is the problem that we're interested in? Undoubtedly, we've all been told that that fiber is really good for us, and that is actually true. Even though resistant fibers are good for us, our bodies actually delegate dealing with them to the gastrointestinal or GI microbiome. So our overall question is, how important is the GI microbiome in human evolution? Now, this slide should give us a little bit of insight into the problem that we're dealing with. Food enters the intestinal tract here and then passes into the small intestine. Now, in the small intestine, most of the digestion that occurs is undertaken by enzymes that our body produces. So the nutrients that we break down and absorb at this part of the gut are largely driven by the machinery that we produce and deploy in service of that problem. By the time that food hits the large intestine, what's left are materials that our body really can't do much with. These are primarily resistant fibers and starches. And at this point, we give it over to the microbiome, to the microorganisms, primarily bacteria, that conduct metabolic functions on our behalfs. We're most excited by the fact that this is where our data comes from. Down here. Now, we think that microbiomes bring good things to life. Microbes supply about 6 to 10% of our daily energy supply. We think this is important, and our models of human evolution and thinking about nutrition need to account for what's probably a pretty substantial proportion of our daily energy supply. They also produce short-chain fatty acids. Now, these are extremely important energy sources. They actually supply nutrients that are directed directly to the intestinal lining. So the cells of the inside of our large intestine don't actually receive a blood supply. They're on the microbe's energetic ledger. So again, thinking about expensive tissues, we're actually removing these particular tissues from our budget. We're extremely interested in the fact that microbes produce hormones and vitamins. And of these, B vitamins might be very, very important, including folate, B6, and B12. And I'll touch on that just a little bit later, but these are very important vitamins in terms of brain development. They also affect obesity and appetite control. So some of the ideas that we have about fat probably at this point now need to involve the microbiome, gastrointestinal microbiome. This gives a brief overview of what actually happens in the large intestine. As I noted, we're presented with resistant fibers and starches. Microbes begin breaking this down and removing sugars from those substances, and then conducting a fermentation process here. Now, that's what's most important because it produces the short-chain fatty acids. There are secondary products that find their way into being short-chain fatty acids as well as waste products that are produced via this process. So the host has to manage not only production of things that are very, very good for it, the microbiome has to process the waste products from this particular process, And then if everything works the way it should, those substances are passed into the blood supply to assist with host energy balances. Now, why do we think that knowing about microbiomes and human evolution is important? I think we need to, we really can't ignore the nutrients that derive from this source. So we know a lot about teeth, we know a lot about soft tissues, muscles, and so on. We think it's very important to think about the nutrients that come from this process. They may well add up to be quite significant. They also impact many tissues, as is shown here from a recent paper that draws some kind of correlate between what happens in the microbiome, the gut microbiome, and other tissues in the body. Experimental results are also very interesting in this regard. This is a fat mouse, in case you can't tell, and this is a not fat mouse over here. Now, the main difference between these mice is that they've been implanted with the microbiome from an obese individual, I'll let you guess which one, and a lean individual. These are sterile or notobiotic or germ-free mice that have been implanted with microbiomes from human individuals, and you can see a rather dramatic phenotypic result from this. Anytime fat's involved, we're interested for many reasons, and because it suggests something about metabolism and energy balances. The sheer scale of these interactions is also really important to us. There are trillions of microbes in us, on us, and around us at this moment, conducting a range of functions. So the sheer scale alone, we think, makes this interesting in the context of human evolution. Microbial products promote brain growth through the B vitamins that I talked about. They impact longevity because short-chain fatty acids are, in fact, cancer inhibitors. So there may be some link here with longevity. So we are asking whether or not they have brain growth roles or roles in the evolution of longevity. As we'll learn a little bit more today, some of our ancestors ate very, very high fiber diets. And so one question that we're very interested in is whether or not our ancestors had to negotiate new relationships with microbes or arrangements. There's a possibility that our microbiomes were effectively liberated, or we were liberated from our microbiomes because of the changes that occur when we cook. Finally, we might ask whether or not we were occupied by novel microbes that could confer different kinds of advantages to us as hosts. So what are we doing about all of this? We're conducting comparative analyses of primate gastrointestinal microbiomes, or what I'll call GI microbiomes. We're analyzing bacterial DNA from fecal samples from both wild and captive primate populations to understand these microbiomes. How are we doing this? Our study breaks into two major parts. The first part is taxonomy, in essence, looking at the structure of the microbiome. Who's there? How is it structured? How are the bacteria in the microbiome related to one another, and do those differ across primate species? We're taking advantage of new, very new sequencing technologies that generate incredible quantities of data, and we're actually taking advantage of 16S RNA molecule, which is very conservative in bacteria and allows us to make statements about bacterial taxonomy, running it through various pipelines to get to the point of statistics and interpretation. So the first part of our project is really taxonomic. The second part is what's called metagenomic or functional. Here we're trying to figure out what the genes that come with the microbes are actually doing. So we're saying, what's the taxonomy, what's the structure of the ecosystem, and we're asking, what does that ecosystem do? And again, using various sequencing technologies to get to that. What are we finding? We're finding some very interesting results with our cross-species comparison, so I'm going to give kind of a limited view of those here today. One thing we seem to be finding is integration between diets and microbiomes. And the example that I'm showing here is from black howler monkeys, or Alouatta pigra. This is an endangered species that occupies the Yucatan Peninsula. The population has been under investigation by Dr. Alejandro Estrada for many years, and these results were generated by one of our brilliant graduate students, Ms. Katie Amato. Now, it's slightly complicated, so let me walk you through it. We have different habitats, including a continuous rainforest, a semi-deciduous habitat, a rainforest fragment, and captivity. And what we're finding is that rainforest monkey microbiomes harbor many more microbial species. These are the black, high, and steep lines that you see in the graph, while those in semi-deciduous forests and fragments do not. So what we're seeing is the quantity of DNA that we're reading. So this is just what we can read from the DNA that's coming out of the sequencing machines. And then we're making a decision about the microbial species that are present. If you have 97% similar sequences, we put you in the same bin. And what we can see is that the rainforest monkeys have many, many more microbial species in their guts, whereas the animals that are in habitats that are probably not as good have many fewer microbial species in their guts. In fact, in this group, all of the captive animals died, and you might see why in just a minute. We think, therefore, that there are some very important correlations between habitat quality and microbiome that might be very important in primate conservation and may give us some insights into human evolution, because we are fundamentally talking about habitat changes. Let me take another look at this. This is another view of what we were just talking about: our rainforest, our fragments, our semi-deciduous, and then our captives. We could look at this graph as kind of a map of four different cities. Each city has a number of neighborhoods in it, and these neighborhoods are composed of related microbial taxa. So there's a blue family group, if you will. There's a group of related people or microbes living in a neighborhood in each one of these cities. And you can see that in this particular city, we have lots and lots of neighborhoods. Some of these are very densely occupied, and there are close interactions among them. The lines are showing interactions among these microbial taxa. Some are more like the suburbs, where you have very sparsely occupied parts of the city where there's not much interaction. As habitat quality, in some ways, goes down, we can see that neighborhoods are entirely lost in the animals that are in a less desirable habitat. And by the time we start looking at the captive habitat, we can see what are probably fundamental changes to that city. Only the most densely populated neighborhood remains. Pretty much everything else is gone. We think this could be very important as a tool for understanding the overall health of the microbiome more generally. Let's take a brief look at humans in comparative perspective, and I'll go back to what we were talking about, taxonomy and metagenomics here. Now, I'm oversimplifying a lot, but what we think we're seeing are some fairly substantial differences between human and non-human primate microbiomes. Here we're looking at something a little different. We're looking at the 50 most common bacterial phyla along the x-axis, and then we're looking at a count of how often they're present along the y-axis. And what you can see with the human microbiome, including infants and adults, is kind of a lazy L shape to that curve. The first three or four bacterial phyla are present in very high abundance, and then it drops off quite significantly thereafter, and then becomes quite trivial in the case of infants. And that makes sense. Infants are born without microbiomes. They acquire them from the environment. We think that there are some important differences between the human microbiome and the non-human microbiome, and that we don't see that kind of lazy L curve to the non-human primate taxon. Again, this is more complicated than I'm presenting it, but it could suggest some fairly important reorganizations of human microbiomes. I hope this slide isn't too complicated, but if anyone has socks that look like this, I want a photograph. These are results that tell us about metagenome function or genome function in the microbial populations. Now, the tool that we're using gives us information about 28 primary functions. These are two of the functions. These are two of the three most important functions that we can identify. So let me walk this through you. What we're saying here is that this blue howler monkey, each bar is an individual animal. The blue howler monkey is conducting probably a little more than 10%, maybe 11% of the genes that we can pull out of the microbiome are dedicated to protein metabolism. When we drill down into this, what we find is that most of that is protein biosynthesis. So what we're saying is that over 10% of the genes in the microbes from non-human primates are devoted towards manufacturing protein. As you can see in humans down here, it looks like less than 10% of the total genome from the microbes is involved in protein biosynthesis. So we think there's a difference between non-human and human primates in terms of actually making proteins. The pattern is reversed when we start looking at carbohydrates. And here again, our first blue howler and then humans, we can see that processes or genes that have something to do with carbohydrate processing are a little less common in non-human primates, but they're more common in humans in this particular example. And again, we're talking about 28 general functions here, so if these were allocated simply randomly, we'd be talking about 3% gene function. So this is a substantial portion, we think, of the microbial genome that's dedicated to these particular functions. So let's try to round things out and think about what we have. I think we're finding dynamic relations between primates and their gut microbiomes. We can't just take one gut microbiome and put it into all different primate species. There's important variation here that we need to know about. And I think our howler monkeys are saying very clearly that this is a dynamic relation. We're actually quite worried about this from a conservation perspective because it looks like when the external habitat starts crashing, so does the internal habitat. And I want to publicly congratulate Ms. Amato for looking at this and having so much to worry about, not only external but internal ecosystems. We think that human microbiomes are distinct from those of non-human primate microbiomes. This seems to be the case taxonomically, where we don't have microbiomes that are as rich and diverse as those of non-human primate species. And it looks like there are functional differences as well, with the human microbiome conducting a little less protein metabolism, but more carbohydrate processing. Now, what are the implications for human evolution? I think we can expect that microbiomes change with diets across the course of human evolution. Of course, unfortunately, as far as I can tell, we can't directly get those microbes out, but it's something to think about when we talk about climate change, diet change, and so on and so forth. And the howlers may give us some guidance on that issue, as well as other species that we're looking at. The taxonomic data seem to be showing some significant reorganization of the human microbiome. We might be thinking about release from protein metabolism. We're asking how important are microbes for brain evolution, and our large-scale comparative analyses will be addressing that. So what are some next steps? We're very interested in documenting additional covariation between microbes, habitats, and primate morphologies, particularly brain sizes. And as our comparative studies develop, we'll be able to look at that more carefully. We're extremely interested in B vitamins, and I haven't talked about those very much here today, but we're looking closely at those, particularly in terms of the functional data that we talked about. And we're also interested in looking at protein metabolism versus brain size in primates. I have a lot of people to thank. I'd, again, like to thank Ms. Amato for excellent work, as well as our postdoc, Carl Yeoman, who has been a remarkable part of this project, as well as a number of collaborators and the National Science Foundation. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to be talking about the early part of the human fossil record, the Australopiths. Diet is the single most important parameter that underlies the behavioral and ecological differences among living primates. We know from studies of living primates that group size, group structure, positional behavior, locomotion, on and on and on, all of these and other things are affected by diet. And so if we can understand something about the diets of our ancestors, we should be able to say quite a bit about the lives of those ancestors. Also, diet is important from the perspective of understanding the role of a hominin in its environment. Since environmental change is supposed to be the trigger for human evolution, if we can understand something about diet and how that changes with environment, we can again say something about, in this case, how and why and where humans evolved. So it's very important to us paleoanthropologists to study diet. There are other reasons that we look at diet of early hominins. These and many other books have sold millions and millions of copies. A lot of people believe that there's a discordance between what we eat today, what our ancestors evolved to eat, and that is why we have so many of the chronic degenerative diseases we have, obesity, and so forth. One of my favorite quotes from any of these books is Dr. Adkins' new diet, is from Dr. Adkins' New Diet Revolution. And this particular book sold 15 million copies. He wrote, "The human animal was able for millions of years to remain strong and healthy in conditions of often savage deprivation by eating the fish and animals that scampered and swam around him and the fruits and vegetables and berries that grew nearby." Okay. Probably true. It's intuitive. But where did he get this? How did he know this? What do we really know about the diets of our ancestors from millions of years ago? And that's a question I'd like to address in this presentation. What is the actual hard evidence for the diets of human ancestors and our near cousins, the early hominins, of millions of years ago? And what can we really say about the diets of these hominins? Well, since no one else is going to do it, I guess I will. I'd like to quickly give those of you who are not familiar with the human fossil record a very quick, very down and dirty, very simplified preview or tour, if you will, of that fossil record. Basically, it stretches about 7 million years, and these are abouts I'm giving you here, and includes roughly four groups, or you can divide them into four groups. The first group you can call the earliest putative hominins from about 7 million years ago. This one's from Chad. These are, until we get to about here, they're all from Africa. And then from Kenya and then Ethiopia. Probably the best known of this group is Ardipithecus ramidus. These were, best we can tell, still largely in the trees. Best we can tell, more or less woodland species, not unlike some chimpanzees today, presumably in terms of both the way they moved about the landscape and the sorts of things they ate. I'm not going to spend much time talking about them, largely because they're still under study and the dietary analyses are in progress today. I don't know as much about them either. The next group is what we'd call the genus Australopithecus. There are several species of Australopithecus. I'm sure people in this room differ in the number of species they recognize, but that's okay. We've got some from Chad, but most of them come from East Africa, and this is the Lucy species, Australopithecus afarensis, as well as South Africa. And this one here is Australopithecus sediba, fairly recently discovered. Fine. These ones had not abandoned the trees, but certainly had come down to the ground, and we have evidence of them walking around and in the way of footprints, things of that nature. Essentially, they lived from just over 4 million years ago, maybe 4.2, to just under 2 million years ago. The next group is a group we can call Paranthropus. These are one of two evolutionary forks in the road that happened something like 2.5 million years ago. Paranthropus are presumably our near cousins. They are relatives of ours. They presumably did not give direct rise to us, and yet they're interesting in their own right, largely because of the tremendous degree of specialization that they show. The fourth group is the group Homo. The earliest members of our own genus show up in the fossil record about, say, 2.4 million years ago or so, and they continue up to the present. Just under 2 million years, 1.85, 1.9, we get Homo erectus, which is more or less committed to the ground, the first hominin species presumably to leave Africa, and so forth. I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the latter three groups. What evidence do we have for diet? Well, teeth. Teeth are the best evidence, largely because they're the most common fossils we get in most vertebrate assemblages, and they're durable parts of the digestive system. They're, in fact, the only part of the body that comes in contact with food that we find in the fossil record. So if we can't get it out of teeth, we're probably not going to get it out of anything, at least at this point. Fortunately, there are predictable relationships between diet and the sizes, shapes, and structure of teeth. So, for example, if we look at living primates, we can look at the sizes, shapes, and structures of their teeth and say, hey, these relate to these specific diets. And we can use that to infer something about diet from the sizes, shapes, and structures of teeth of the fossils. Likewise, teeth preserve what you can call food prints. These are traces of foods eaten, like footprints in the sand, if you will. They're actual traces or records of what an individual ate in the past. The best examples of these are the chemistry of the teeth and the wear, the use wear of the teeth. And these leave predictable patterns, too, we've established through studies of living primates between the pattern and the diet. So if we see the pattern in fossils, we should be able to infer something about the diet. So I'm going to talk about first Australopithecus, this roughly 4 to 2 million-year-old series of species of hominins. They're also called the gracile australopiths because, at least compared to the other ones, their skulls are fairly slender, their jaws are fairly slender, not compared to us, but compared to the other australopiths, and we'll talk about their teeth in a moment. The Paranthropus group from about 2.5 million years ago to maybe 1.3 or so, they're called the robust australopiths because their skulls and jaws are so big and heavy, and that makes them robust. And then we'll talk a little bit about Homo from about 2.5 million years, 2.4 million years onward. Again, just under 2 million years ago, Homo erectus. And they seem to show less of an emphasis on chewing anatomy, particularly in the skull and the jaw. Okay, so what evidence do we have and what does it tell us? Let's start with tooth size. In theory, larger teeth mean more surface area. More surface area can be used for processing more food, typically low-quality foods, Some have also argued that more surface area means greater probability of smashing into small food particles. If we look at living great apes, this seems to work fairly well. We've got a chimpanzee at the top. There's its three of its teeth. Then we've got an orangutan and a gorilla. And you see an increasing amount, on average, over the course of a year, across populations, of leaf-eating, low-quality vegetation compared to soft, fleshy fruits, as you go from one to the next to the next. And the actual amount of surface area, and these are scaled to the same size, does in fact increase. This doesn't work for all groups of primates, but it certainly works for our nearest living relatives, the great apes. What about the hominins? Well, hominins are really interesting because they have big teeth, bigger teeth than you might expect. Here is a Paranthropus third molar tooth. I think it's probably the biggest one in the assemblage as compared to a modern human tooth, and they're sitting right next to each other in the museum. Some of them have incredibly large teeth. They're called megadont. And Australopithecus as a group has big cheek teeth. Paranthropus as a group has huge molar teeth. And early Homo has, on average, smaller tooth sizes, especially from Homo erectus onward. We'll talk about what that means in just a moment, but let's go to tooth shape. Theory: blunt, flat teeth are good for crushing hard, brittle foods. Not because they're better at crushing foods, but because they're better at avoiding themselves being broken when you've got to put a lot of force on those teeth. So the best tooth really is probably a hemisphere, because if you try and crush hard food with something that's pointy, you're going to break the tooth. On the other hand, sharp teeth are better for shearing or slicing tough items. The best way to illustrate this is think of a hammer smashing a nut versus a knife cutting into steak, or cutting into, or a pair of scissors cutting into a tough leaf. Different shaped teeth, different diets. And here we've got three old world monkey species. At the top we have a mangabey, which at least on occasion gets into very hard foods. And on the bottom we have a silvery leaf monkey, and it eats more leaves. And in the middle we've got a long-tailed macaque, which has a mixed diet dominated by soft fruits. If you look at their teeth, you can see that as you go from the bottom to the top, the cresting becomes heavier and heavier. There's more and more relief on the teeth, and this relates to diet nicely, not just in these old world monkeys, but across the primates, and in fact, across many mammal groups. All right, what about the hominins? They all have pretty flat teeth, actually. Australopithecus has flat molar teeth, even flatter than, say, a chimpanzee. Paranthropus has extremely flat molar teeth at a given stage of wear. And early Homo, it turns out, has a bit more sloping molar teeth. I mean, they're not like carnivores, but more sloping than, say, Australopithecus or Paranthropus. Tooth structure. And we'll look at average enamel molar thickness. Life is really more complicated than this. But the simple story, at least, is that if you look at closely related species, those that tend to eat very hard foods tend to have thicker enamel than those that eat very tough foods. Thick molar enamel is good for resisting breakage. It strengthens the tooth. Thinner enamel, on the other hand, allows you to wear through that enamel quickly and get to the softer dentin on the inside, which creates sharp edges, which are better for shearing and slicing. In principle, thick enamel could also be helpful for resisting wear in a very abrasive environment, since it's wear resistant. So this is what we see when we compare living species. What about the hominins? Well, again, life's pretty complicated. But the general take-home message might be that on average, Australopithecus has thick molar enamel, Paranthropus has extremely thick, it's called hyperthick molar enamel, and early Homo has, on average, thinner enamel, especially from Homo erectus on. In sum, then, large flat molars with thickened dental enamel and a diet of at least some hard, brittle, and perhaps abrasive foods is what has been suggested for Australopithecus. For Paranthropus, very large flat molars with very thick dental enamel and a diet dominated by hard, brittle, and perhaps abrasive foods, dominated, potentially, not just some. And then for early Homo, smaller molars with sloping biting surfaces and thinner enamel, and a diet, maybe some more tough foods, probably fewer hard, brittle ones. Tools may come into this picture as well for processing foods outside of the mouth, and in fact, there are animal bones with cut marks on them, which suggests that meat was at least included as part of the diet at this stage. So the traditional view gives us an Australopithecus. And yes, they lived in a broad range of environments, but the traditional view gives us an Australopithecus living typically in a more closed setting, although some certainly lived in more open settings, taking a broad variety of foods, soft forest fruits, some harder items, and so on. And then about 2.5 million years ago, a fork in the road in one direction, our near cousins Paranthropus, in an open savanna setting, eating hard brittle, abrasive foods, nuts, seeds, roots, tubers, what have you. And early Homo, with perhaps a broader diet, less specialization anatomically, maybe tools are taking over, but that broader diet including, presumably, at least some meat. Well, how does this match up with the traces of foods actually eaten, the food prints, as it were? Tooth size, shape, thickness give us an idea of what a species was capable of eating. In other words, what it was designed for. Tooth wear and chemistry, on the other hand, tell us something about what individuals actually ate on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis, which is a very different kind of information. Both are important. Well, we can begin with microscopic wear on teeth, or dental microwear, scratches and pits that form as a result of tooth use. And if you look very high magnification at a little piece of a tooth, this is about, represents about a tenth of a millimeter by 0.15 millimeter. This is a hard object feeding capuchin monkey, and it's got a very complex, heavily pitted surface. This is a leaf monkey with a very simple, striated surface. And typically speaking, tougher foods, whether you're talking meat or leaves or whatever, leave simple striated surfaces across the mammals. Harder foods leave heavily pitted surfaces across the mammals. Australopithecus, low complexity. Lots of wispy scratches. Paranthropus, some low complexity, but some higher complexity, although variable. So a mixed signal with Paranthropus. Early Homo, low to moderate average complexity, but again variable. Very variable, in fact, in Homo erectus. The last line of evidence would be tooth chemistry. Where these hominins lived, there are basically two different types of photosynthesis going on. The ones that tropical grasses and sedges do, which is C4 plants, and the ones that trees and bushes and forbs do, C3 plants. And there's two different isotopes of carbon, for example, that are stable, carbon-13 and carbon-12. And depending upon the type of photosynthesis you have, you're going to select more against carbon-13 in one case than you are in the other, and that'll show up in the plants, and then it'll show up in the animals that eat them. So browsers that eat forest products will tend to have a different isotope signature than grazers that eat savanna products. When we look at the hominins, there are also some interesting differences. We find Australopithecus is a mixed feeder. Paranthropus, in some cases, they're mixed feeders. In other cases, they seem to go for grasses or sedges. And then early Homo, which comes out as a mixed feeder. This isn't my work. This is the work of many, many different individuals. But there are the results. The microwear suggests a softer or tougher food diet in Australopithecus, on average. The isotopes suggest a mixed diet of forest and savanna resources. So far, so good. Paranthropus, the microwear of some look like broader diets, including some harder foods, but for others, looks like they tended to focus more on softer or tougher foods. The isotopes of those that had broad diets, according to the microwear, seem to have mixed diets in terms of where they were eating, in the forest and savanna. The soft, tough item eaters, on the other hand, ate mostly savanna foods. So two different signals. For early Homo, the microwear suggests a mixed diet of softer, tougher, and harder foods, and the isotopes suggest a mixed diet of forest and savanna resources. So that's where we are at this point. Let's go back for a moment to where we started, to Dr. Adkins' pronouncement about what our ancestors of millions of years ago ate, and that is the fish and animals that scampered and swam around him, and the fruits, vegetables, and berries that grew nearby. Okay, what do we know? Australopithecus likely ate mostly softer or tougher foods, things like fruits and leaves, in a mixed setting between about 4 and 2 million years ago, but could handle a fairly broad diet. Around 2.5 million years ago, there's a fork in the evolutionary road. In one direction, our Paranthropus cousins were more specialized and likely had different diets in different places. Some ate tough savanna foods like grasses and sedges, whereas others included more hard items in their diet, such as nuts and seeds, in a mixed setting. Finally, our early Homo ancestors had less specialized teeth and probably had a broader and more variable diet, including both savanna and forest resources, likely with more meat in their diets. And I just wanted to thank the organizers and CARTA and everyone else for the kind invitation for me to be here. Thank you.
Although I started my career worrying about the difference between modern humans and Neanderthals in Europe, I owe my return to Neanderthals to my collaborators, Dolores Piperno, paleobotanist, and Amanda Henry, my former graduate student who's now heading a research initiative at the Max Planck that is devoted to the issue of the evolution of human diet. So they're very much in this presentation. So Neanderthals, this is the old distribution area of Neanderthals, with the easternmost site being Teshiktash, and then recently we've seen an expansion of the Neanderthal area, which actually the archaeologists always thought was there because the industry associated with Neanderthals goes that far east, but the association of the extension of the actual fossils to include western Siberia. So Neanderthals are a Eurasian species that never seems to have conquered Africa, and who also inhabited the Near East, but intermittently with modern humans. And they are somewhat different. They are contemporary with early modern humans, but they are somewhat different in their anatomy. And there's an argument about what this difference is due to. A very important paper by one of our conference organizers and her collaborator argued that Neanderthals actually were not especially cold-adapted. And in particular, they don't seem to have been culturally cold-adapted. And yet they have these very stocky bodies that would seem to follow Bergman's rule, which argues that you're going to have a more globular body plan in a colder climate. But at any rate, they had differently shaped crania, as you can see below, and quite differently shaped bodies. But basically, they were more massive than we are, and they probably had more body mass to feed, and thus higher caloric requirements. The question about Neanderthals, since they did live at the same time as modern humans were emerging in Africa, and they also, for a long time, were thought to be the direct ancestors of the people in their geographic range, exactly how human, in terms of comparison to us, how human were they? This has varied over time as reflected in these different artistic representations. This is Marcelin Boule's version where the Neanderthals can't even stand up straight. And then we have a vision from the mid-20th century by Zaborian. And then finally a French version of Neanderthals who look not very different from us at all from the year 2000. So this is work by Steve Churchill and others, and also building on some of the material in Aiello and Wheeler, 2003, that Neanderthals had to, if they didn't have clothing, and there's no evidence that they did. So modern humans, in any case, even if they didn't have any clothes, were not so much less cold-adapted than Neanderthals were, is the message. And Neanderthals also had greater surface area because of their more massive bodies. So they needed more calories than modern humans. And these are estimates in Steve Churchill's work of the average adult male Neanderthals' caloric requirements per day and the average adult female's caloric requirements per day, which I think doesn't take into account the pregnant and lactating females that would have dominated certainly the population. So a nuclear family of two parents and two kids would have required almost 15,000 calories a day. Where are they going to get those calories? Was it the same way that we do? Well, a lot of the stories about Neanderthals and a lot of the basis for reconstructing their diet is based on the idea that they were essentially entirely based on meat. The problem is, where were they getting this diet, and is it really a good thing to eat a purely meat diet, which has very, very few carbohydrates? But if you take a big animal that a hunter finally manages to bring down, like an adult caribou, if it's in the late summer, it's probably fat. and more than maybe 60% of its calories are in the form of adipose fat. If you catch it in February, it's none of that fat is going to be there, and the food value goes way down. So a good condition caribou is going to give you maybe 120,000, 130,000 calories. But if it's the spring, you're going to get less than half that. So what Steve calculated is that if only males were doing the hunting, each man needs to bring home almost 8 kilos of meat every day. And each hunter with a wife and two kids needs one fat or two lean caribou a week, which is, given ethnographic stories of hunter-gatherers, this is highly improbable number. Occasionally there's going to be much more than that, but most of the time there's going to be much less. What kind of evidence do we have that humans were actually doing this kind of carnivory? We know that Neanderthals were occasionally driving big animals off a cliff, that they had wooden spears, but they also had very occasionally hafted stone-tipped spears, but there's no evidence that they had projectile weapons. There is some evidence that they were beating out the carnivores, whether it's because they were hunting their prey or living in their caves is unclear. The European Neanderthals did hunt large primates animals. Most of these were not caribou. They were horses, bison, and red deer, who often live in smaller herds, and you have less of these massive migrations going through. The other thing that Neanderthals did not do, and Mary Steiner has talked a great deal about this, is they didn't, for the most part, catch small, fast game. As far as we can tell, they didn't do much fishing. They didn't catch birds or rabbits, and they, except, I should say, very late Neanderthals in Spain. Yet we persist in arguing that they ate more meat than cave bears. And this is largely based, as Margaret will show, on the stable isotope data. There are a lot of problems with arguing that Neanderthals ate more meat than cave bears. And this is the work of John Speth and Kate Spielman from a very important paper in 1983, basically pulling a lot of the anecdotal data and the hunter's data and the ethnographic data together. The problem with eating a diet that consists mostly of meat is that meat takes a lot of energy to digest, and eating it raises your metabolism, your thermal output, up to 30% rather than the 6 to 12% you get from eating carbohydrates and fat. It also leads to many other unfortunate outcomes, a negative nitrogen balance. You start excreting nitrogen. You deplete your protein reserves. You lose muscle. It also affects calcium absorption and depletes your fatty acids, which is not the direction you want to go in if you want to grow a big brain. So the calories can be adequate, but if you eat 80 to 90% of your calories from lean meat, and the meat would have been lean for a good third to half of the year, this can mimic starvation. What about the plant foods? And I'm going to talk a little bit about a new approach that Amanda Henry and Dolores and I have worked on, and this is the microfossils that are preserved in your dental calculus if you don't go to a dentist. That stuff that forms on your teeth and hardens incorporates microfossils from, or potential microfossils from, the food you eat. And people have known this for a while, but what they were looking for were phytoliths. And we don't eat too many foods that have these little silica grains that grow in leaves and stems, because we don't live on leaves and stems. We live on starches and meat and honey. And so we need to know, are the starch grains preserved? And the answer that we came up with was starch grains are preserved in dental calculus for at least 200,000 years in every possible climate that we've looked at. And starch grains can be assigned to a taxon, usually at least a plant type, if not a, and often a family, and sometimes even a genus or a species, by the dimples, which are the green arrow, the hilum, which is the center around which the starch forms, the lamellae, which are the thin parallel lines that represent the formation of the starch, and then the fissure in the starch. And each species has a very distinctive starch. And also the other characteristic is when you put them under cross-polarized light, as in the bottom picture, there's a very distinctive pattern of extinction crosses. So we studied plant microfossils on teeth and on the associated tools for from a whole lot of sites in the old world, and I'll just go by this, but you, just so that you can see that it covers everything from 50 degrees north to 25 degrees north and then down to 28 degrees south in South Africa. And we have starch grains on a large number of teeth from the sample. Just to summarize what we found, grass seed starches, the surprise was that the starches of grass seeds and other probable of Tritaceae, which are the wheat, the barley, and some other oat grass and other kinds of grasses, were the most common kind of starch. These are common across all the samples from Belgium to South Africa, suggesting heavy use of large grains grass seeds through time. We also had some legume starches, but we also had a lot of starches that were consistent with plant underground storage organs. The other thing that was interesting about this data is that most of our samples had a large number of different starch types, so that Spee in Belgium at the northern end of our range and Shanidar, who's the southernmost Neanderthal we looked at, each had almost 50 different types of plants on their teeth. Did they cook? The question is, how did they eat these starches? Were they eating them raw? And we've argued that these were some of Amanda's experiments with all kinds of starches, showing what happens to them if you boil them, bake them, or parch them. And if you look at the boiled 5 minutes picture of barley, when we looked at the Shanidar Neanderthal, we found on its teeth, and this is the upper right picture, that it was very, very close to a 5 minute boiling in water picture. So we've argued that this is, and we had several grains like this on this tooth, we've argued that they were eating barley porridge, basically. They were cooking the barley in water. We have yet to figure out, it's a little bit like the fire problem. We have this evidence arguing that they cooked it in water, yet we don't have any pots, so how are they doing it? That's the next archaeological problem. And with that, I pass the baton to Margaret, who's going to talk. The problem with this plant data, of course, is that it conflicts with not only with the idea of the all-meat diet, but some of the evidence for the all-meat diet. So,
This is work that came out of Peter Unger's lab, and it is based on a couple of papers, and I want to thank Peter for the picture here. These are microware on Neanderthal tooth surfaces, and I would say in some, based on what Peter has also written, that it shows some plant eating. So these are just the data from Neanderthal tooth surfaces, and what you have here are some that are open steppe areas, some that are from mixed forest areas, and some that are from wooded areas. And what their results show, these are the same kind of surfaces that he was showing you on the Australopithecus. What he showed is that at the top, where you have the more open steppe, he was concluding more meat, less dietary diversity, I think, is what is significant for what Allison and I would like to say. And then in the middle, where you have a mixed set of ecologies, you have less meat and more dietary diversity. And when you get to the wooded regions, you have much higher dietary diversity. Now, how do you get that kind of diversity when in some of the areas in which we know Neanderthals lived, we don't seem to have, at least ecologically, much diversity for them to be picking anything from? So this is work that it was done at Amud in Israel. And today, the Israeli Neanderthals are living in what's called an Orano-Turanian zone. And that is a zone that is extremely dry. It has an area of remnant oaks. And what they have now is an area with, they have virtually no date palms in this area. They have a single wet season that's in the cold, and the oaks are as remnant, or in this area there are no oaks. What my graduate student Chris Howland and I did and had recently published in the Journal of Human Evolution is that if you can use the composition of oxygen to be able to get at some ecological reconstructions, and so that is what we attempted to do. Now, the way this works, I'll just go over the method very briefly, is that you have herbivore physiology that deals with its body water in very different ways. So if you take an animal like a gazelle that is obtaining all of its body water from leaves, what you see is with high aridity, you have a high composition of the heavy isotope, so you have a high value of delta 018. If you take something like a goat that is an obligate drinker and it's getting its water from pools, when so is not as subject to the aridity signal, what you find is that you have a delta 018 value in rain that is low when you have cold temperatures. So you can use these two different animals to get at two different aspects of ecology. You can use the one that eats leaf to get at aridity, non-aridity. You can look at the goats to get at what temperature at which the rain fell, because you know what that is how the delta 018 works. So you can actually track what temperature things were. Not the exact temperature, but relative temperature. So what we did is we took goat teeth and sectioned them down the goat tooth. One goat tooth covers a 12-month period, so you're actually having one annual cycle per goat tooth if you're looking at either an M2 or an M3. And in this case, we had both. What you have is this is down at the margin, down here and up here. The way the teeth grow, this is the older, this is the younger. So you can actually track down the life of the tooth and period over a year. What we showed with the goats is given these curves like this, we definitely have periods of cold rains with low delta 018, and you compare that with periods of warm rains with high delta 018, so you go cold, warm, cold. And then if you go to the next one, you got it again. So, okay, we also did gazelles. I won't show you those data. But with gazelles, you look at an aridity signal. The teeth only cover 3 months, so you're basically looking at one season. And some of them had, we looked at all second molars, and we saw that some second molars were actually mineralized during dry seasons, and some second molars were what we would call drier seasons, and some were formed during wetter seasons. Gazelle only have two birth seasons at times of a lot of rain, and so we know that if they're having births in two seasons, it probably has a high rain intake. So based on rain and cold and wet, and rain and wetter and drier, we concluded that there was more rain and probably rain throughout the year. So unlike today's Israel, it has rain only once, and we tend to think of that as how a mud lived. That is not how they lived. And so this is actually a site of Kafsa, which is not the site of a mud, but probably at the time Neanderthals lived there, it looked much more like this, which was a much wetter area, and we think that probably what are now remnant oaks may have been spread much wider, and other nut-like things, pistachios, perhaps even almonds, were also available to them. And that might, in fact, explain some of the complexity that you see in the tooth data. But let's get to what really started this whole thing about carnivory and Neanderthals, and I want to go over it just a little bit. What we have here are three different sites. This is the work of Mike Richards, published in most recently in JHE, but then with others in additional after that. And basically, well, the reason it was sorted on this is because you look at a delta N15, and that's off the edge here. That's a signal of 15-14 in terms of two isotopes of nitrogen. And basically what you see is that the Neanderthals are always higher then this is would be a mixed carnivore, but it was the only one in which had where I had them at all sites. Wolves are the top carnivore in this area, but there was one wolf, so it wouldn't have done me very much good to compare it with that. So I plotted, and I tried to get the same kind of animals everywhere. So basically here are the deer, and Neanderthals are higher than the mixed carnivore, and so the idea was that they are actually top carnivores, based on the delta N15 values. And it's something that's bothered me for quite a while, largely because of John Speth and the work that he and Spielman did. So what is the model that all that's based on? Why are we even expecting that kind of relationship? And this is the reason why we expect it, is because there were large studies. This was actually my postdoc. You look at the nitrogen values up here, so just look at the blue. I'm not expecting you to see the numbers. All I want to say is that if you look at plants, the numbers are relatively low. The animals that feed on those plants are somewhat elevated by about 3. And you look at, so this is a plant eater. You look at the wolf that's feeding on the deer that feeds on the rabbit, and it's at the highest end. So that is what a carnivore looks like. The other issue is the marine system versus the terrestrial system. And again, you start low with plankton and krill. You move up to the plankton eater. You finally get up to the toothed whales, and they are the highest in the system. So if you have a human that it looks like a toothed whale, then you say, okay, it's feeding on marine meat. The thing is where you plunk the humans in, and here you go, you plunk them in just based on comparing them with those animals and whether the animals sit, and so that's what I started thinking about. The problem is that every time I did a trophic system, humans always look like carnivores. It doesn't matter what trophic system I do, and I've done a number of them over the years, they look like carnivores. So what we have here is Pecos Pueblo. They are agriculturalists. We know they are not top carnivores. We know that because they're living people, so we know what they were doing. So if you were just to have them as Neanderthals, what you would have is you've got your grass feeders down here, and you've got a large felid here feeding on them and all that. So you expect. But lo and behold, the other thing we have with these guys is we have the plants. We don't have those with the Neanderthals. And if you plot the plants, then you start seeing that some of these plants are of high delta ON15 too. The amaranth is plotting up there. The corn is plotting up there. The tubers are even plotting up there. So why is this? It's because what they did, the model, which I must admit I lived on for a long time, when we did that model, we were looking at animals that were feeding at, were not selecting in terms of the portion of the plant that was of the highest nutritional value, which is exactly what humans do. And the other thing that humans do is probably digest differently, and they probably cook. And so maybe there's actually uptake of more. And I'll just go through a quick one. It's not just that here, Great Basin people, who are foragers. Again, waterfowl, fish, bighorn sheep, wolf, we're obviously top carnivores. But you pot the plants and it's not quite that simple anymore. So what do you have up here? You have the cattail and you've got the tubers. They ate the tubers, they ate the pollen, everything off of it. So where are we? What I'd like to say is I think what Allison and I have put together, it is quite unlikely that any Neanderthals lived by meat alone, and part of that is based on the rabbit starvation that Speth and Spielman put together in 1983. The other thing is that those big Neanderthal bodies would have required more kilograms that you could extract that way, but which you can easily extract from a plant, especially if you're cooking it. And then you have more kcals required in more the colder areas. They had no projectile weapons. The dental calculus shows us they were eating plants. I think the microware is also showing us that they eat plants. And I would say that until we get some good nitrogen plant data, we don't know, but what you're getting that nitrogen value from is a nutrient-dense portion of a plant that only humans can select.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.